So gravitational atoms is the name we use for super-hadron clouds, and I'm going to explain why. Okay, I guess we can just get started. So I'll try to present many works in this talk. In fact, most of them are like most of my PhD research. There's a series of papers done mostly by people at the University of Amsterdam. The first ones were done by Hornsheng Chia, who was a PhD here before me, and then I kind of continued his work. So I will present some results from his works and then newer results from me and collaborators, including one upcoming work. Okay, so let's start with some motivation. The idea is to do fundamental physics with gravitational waves. So usually when one wants to do fundamental physics, for example, say discovering new particles, a strategy that has historically worked very well is increase the energy of your experiment. You increase the energy and you're going to discover new particles, like at colliders. Now, this is a strategy that works very well. As long as the new physics is coupled strongly enough to the one you already know, say to the Standard Model. However, it's possible new physics doesn't hide at higher energy, but rather at weaker coupling. For example, new physics may only couple, say, gravitationally to the Standard Model. And so here we have in mind, for example, very light particles like axions or axion-like particles. Sometimes they are assumed to have weak couplings to the Standard Model, for example, photons, but what I'm going to discuss today doesn't rely on any coupling different than gravity. So the main mechanism that allows you to probe the specific kind of particles with gravitational waves relies on the so-called super-radiant instability. So I'm going to explain very quickly what that is. If you have more questions, you can ask them and I can expand. So if you have a Kerr black hole in general relativity, that's a stable solution of the Einstein equations. However, when you consider general relativity plus massive bosonic field, and in this talk we'll focus on the spin zero case, then the system becomes unstable. The Kerr metric becomes unstable against perturbations of the boson field. This is called the super-radiant instability. What happens is that some modes of the field have an amplitude that grows exponentially with time. So if you wait long enough, you end up with what we call a cloud, which is depicted here in blue, around a black hole. Until you saturate the instability. And these clouds are long-lived on astrophysical time scales and also can grow very fast. And so they are objects that can they can like we can expect to find them astrophysically. This system, black hole plus cloud, is also called gravitational atom for a good reason, because if you start with a relativistic wave equation, say the Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar case, and you make a non-relativistic ansatz, so you trade the relativistic field variable phi with some non-relativistic variable psi, then psi follows Schrödinger-like equation, which is this one, where the potential minus alpha over r is just the familiar Coulomb-like potential, where of course the numerator is not given by the electromagnetic coupling, but rather by the gravitational coupling. So it's just the product of masses, the product of the mass of the black hole and the mass of the boson, where I have set a Newton's constant to one. Now this is an expansion, a non-relativistic expansion, so there will be subleading terms here. But if the field, like if the cloud is much larger than the size of the black hole, then it's substantially only probing the weak field region. So this is a good approximation. It's only sensitive to the Newtonian tail of the potential. Now, the numerator of this interaction, we still call it alpha, like in electromagnetism, and we also call it fine structure constant for analogy with the EM. And for the cloud to grow fast enough on astrophysical timescales, you want this number to be roughly of order 1 or 0.1, something like that. So if this coupling is too small or too large, then the instability is mathematically there. However, it's too slow to develop astrophysically. Like it's going to take much longer than the age of the universe. If you plug in numbers and you put, for example, say 10 solar masses for the mass of the black hole, so say the black holes that LIGO Virgo measure, detect, then the mass of the boson mu that finds this sweet spot is around 10 to the minus 11 electron volts. So if you then you want to consider, for example, supermassive black holes, so you multiply by, say, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, the mass of the central black hole, then mu decreases by the same amount of order of magnitude. So we are probing here, this region here, between 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 10 electron volts, more or less, with astrophysical black holes. Okay, so same equations have same solutions. So we already know the spectrum of that Schrodinger equation. It's just the hydrogenic spectrum. So you can label the eigenstates with three quantum numbers. N labels the energy. L labels the angular momentum. And then at fixed L and N, you have a multiplet of 12 plus 1 states that are then labeled by M, which is the magnetic quantum number. Now, these states have a small energy splitting due to the subleading corrections to the Schrödinger equation, so the terms I haven't shown in the previous slide. And what superradiance does is typically to populate the highest state in energy in one of those multiplets. For example, 211 here, which would be the highest of these three lines, that would be called the 2p state with atomic notation you may be familiar with. Okay, then on top of the bound states, there are also kind of towers of unbound states. So if you take the energy to be larger than one, you find like scattering states where the boson is not gravitationally bound to the black hole. And these are not discrete. They have a continuous spectrum that is labeled by the same quantum numbers where you trade N for a continuous wave number K. Okay, so the idea is to have a system where we have a gravitational atom and a binary companion. We mostly have in mind intermediate to extreme mass ratio systems. If you have questions on why we use this assumption, I can elaborate on this more after I have explained other aspects of the problem. So when you consider a gravitational atom in a binary system, you find a very, very rich phenomenology. Basically, any atomic phenomena you may think about or you may remember from atomic physics has its analog here. For example, Rabi oscillations or photoelectric effects and so on all have their analogs, and they can be triggered by the interaction with the binary. So I'm going to explain now the two most striking phenomena. So first, how do we, like, why does the interaction with the binary trigger this phenomenon? It's because the cloud interacts with the binary gravitationally. So the Schrödinger equation gets a correction. You don't just have the Newtonian term here, but also a perturbation that is just the gravitational potential of the interaction between the companion and the cloud. Now, I know this is a strong gravity group. However, Here we are going to stick with Newtonian approximation. There are good reasons for that, mainly because alpha is usually small enough so that the most interesting effects happen geometrically far away from the black hole horizon. That being said, so most of what I'm going to discuss is in the Newtonian approximation. There have been recent new results that do include relativistic corrections. If you want, we can discuss them at the end. So this gravitational perturbation is periodic because the binary has a periodic motion. So in general, its matrix elements between two states A and B of the cloud can be expanded in a Fourier series, something like this. So when you have periodic perturbations in quantum mechanics, you may remember they can trigger transitions between different states. And indeed, this is the first thing we discuss, the so-called resonances. So whenever the frequency of oscillation of the perturbation matches the energy difference between two states of the gravitational atom, then you can trigger a resonance between those states. And as we will see, the cloud can be transferred from one state to another. Now, the frequency corresponding to these resonances can be calculated as a function of the parameters of the system. Sorry, there's some music here apparently. Tell me if it's too loud for you.
No,
Okay. I didn't
it's great.
expect the noise at 9 o'clock in the office, but okay. So if you take a reasonable value for alpha and intermediate to extreme values of the mass of the central black hole, then the value of omega falls in the millihertz region. So that's a value interesting for future gravitational wave interferometers like LISA. Now, admittedly, we don't know if black holes of 10 to the 4 solar mass actually exist. They are conjectured to exist. But in fact, they seem to be the maybe the best target for this kind of effects, especially if you consider a small enough mass ratio. Okay, so what happens when the binary frequency has these values? Well, not quite the Rabi oscillations as you might expect, but rather another phenomenon that is also well known in quantum mechanics but less well known in Rabi oscillations, that is called Landau-Zener transitions. So if you restrict your attention to a two-state system, so the two states that are resonating at a given point during the spiral, the Hamiltonian looks something like this. On the diagonal, you have the energy of the two states. Here I've just rescaled to have a traceless Hamiltonian. And off diagonal, you have the perturbation that oscillates very fast while the binary why as the companion moves around the central black hole. Now you can do a transformation of this Hamiltonian to recast it in this form, where you trade the fast oscillation here. So sorry, this is meant to be eta times e to the I phi. So these are exponentials. So you trade this fast exponential for a slow for the slow motion that is due to the increase in omega because the binary slowly spirals, so the frequency chirps with time. Now, this Hamiltonian here on the right is well known in quantum mechanics. If omega is a linear function of time, so you can assume close enough to resonance that the chirp is linear, and this is called the Landau-Zener Hamiltonian. And it has a well-known solution where if you assume that you start in one state, so the state initially populated by super radiance, here depicted in orange, what happens is that the system undergoes a transition. Depending on the value of this parameter z called the Landau-Zener parameter, if z is very large, then the transition is adiabatic. So it's very slow, and the system, so the cloud completely transfers from the first state to the second state. Conversely, if z is very small, you have a diabatic or non-adiabatic transition, where only a small fraction of the cloud is transferred to the new state. This is the impact on the cloud. Conversely, this has a back reaction on the binary. Because, for example, imagine you are resonating from a state with high energy to a state with lower energy. Then, to make the transition, the binary has to absorb energy from the cloud, because the energy of the cloud has to decrease to allow the transition to happen. But if the binary absorbs energy, then it's replenishing its energy that is being depleted by gravitational wave emission. So you have a period of slowed down in spiral, which we called a floating orbit, which is depicted here schematically in red. Instead, if you transition to a higher energy state, you have what we call a sinking orbit, where the spiral is sped up for a certain amount of time. And so the sequence of resonances and their impact on the gravitational wave signal characterizes the spectrum of the gravitational outcome. And the value of these frequencies, as I said earlier, is related quite easily to the parameters of the system. Okay, this is the first big phenomenon that can happen. The second one instead is the analog of the photoelectric effect, and we call it ionization. So if you remember from atomic physics, famously, if you shine light on a metal, nothing happens if the frequency of the light is not high enough. Instead, if the frequency is above some given threshold, the quanta of light are large enough to excite electrons into continuum states. So electrons are able to escape the metal, and you have the so-called photoelectric effect. Here you can have the same things. The analog is basically the ionization, so the transition from a bound state, the one where the cloud is, to one of the towers of unbound states with positive energy. The threshold in frequency here corresponds to the energy gap, here this EB, between the bound state and the start of the continuum. And a thresholding frequency also correspond to, if you assume quasi-circular orbits, a threshold in separation. So if you want the frequency to be higher than a certain threshold, then the binary has to be more complex than a certain separation. Okay, how do we compute the rate of this phenomenon? Well, the easiest way, in my opinion, to calculate it is by just using Fermi's golden rule. So you forget for a second that the frequency of the perturbation is lightly chirp is slowly chirping. You assume it's constant. You apply Fermi's golden rule, and you have your. Sorry? And you
I
have
think someone just coughed. Sorry.
the rate gamma of the process that is expressed as a function of the level mixing, which is basically the matrix element of the perturbation between the initial and the final state, and some delta function here, which ensures that the final energy is equal to the initial energy plus g times the quantum of frequency, the quantum of energy you're giving, which corresponds to the frequency of the binary in this case. Okay, so you can compute the rate of ionization this way. And then a more probably more interesting quantity is to integrate this effect over all possible final states, because we're probably not going to observe the scalar waves emitted by the system, but rather, for example, how much energy the binary loses because it's pumping its energy into the cloud to ionize it. So you can compute what we call the ionization power, so the energy per unit time spent by the binary ionizing the cloud. And it has some complicated expression here that depends on these etas, which are, again, the matrix element of the perturbation. And it's a very complicated and messy sum over all possible final states. Nevertheless, you can just evaluate this numerically. And now I'm going to show the result, which is this one, and go through this plot together. So first of all, in the top panel here, I'm just showing for comparison the profile of the cloud. So this is the probability density of a typical state populated by super radiance, and it peaked at some 50 gravitational radii from the central black hole. In the bottom panel, I'm showing the ionization power normalized by the power in gravitational waves. Okay. So there are two main things to notice about this plot. First, the fact that it's seemingly discontinuous. There are these jumps at multiple points in the like at multiple values of the separation R star. By the way, the two lines here, blue and orange, correspond to the two possible orientations, either the binary rotating in the same direction as the cloud or opposite. And the second thing to notice is the size of the y-axis. So the ionization power is, with this choice of parameters, two orders of magnitude larger than the power emitted in gravitational waves. And this is not even a particularly optimistic choice of parameter. You can very easily get this number to increase by quite a bit. So the effect is huge. There is a region, not too close, where the binary is losing much more energy due to this process rather than gravitational waves. So ionization is actually dominating the dynamics of the binary in this region. Now, if you are disturbed by the discontinuities, first of all, you shouldn't be too surprised, because I said earlier that there are threshold frequencies, just like in the photoelectric effect. Here, they are more than one, because the perturbation, even though it's periodic, it's not monochromatic. So it's as if you were shining not one laser, but like multiple lasers with many different frequencies. So each of them has its own discontinuity. And second, of course, nature is not discontinuous. There's no actual discontinuity. The discontinuity fades away if you do take into account the fact that the frequency is slowly chirping. So what you have is not a sharp transition, of a sharp jump of the ionization power, but some smooth function with some long time oscillating behavior. Nevertheless, if you plug in realistic parameters, these oscillatory behaviors are negligible. Like, oscillations die out pretty fast. So in fact, the features are quasi discontinuous for realistic parameters. Okay. So how does ionization impact the evolution of the system? A discontinuity in the energy loss corresponds to a discontinuity in the first derivative of the frequency as function of time, because you have to take one integral. So in a plot here, I have rescaled the binary frequency, so the gravitational wave frequency, with a power that makes the vacuum case a straight line here. So here, what you find are basically these kinks, so jumps of the first derivative. And their position in frequency is related to the parameters, so the mass of the boson, the state of the cloud, in a similar way as the the resonances I was discussing earlier. This is the formula, if you're curious, where n is the principal quantum number of the cloud. So this is in the LISA band, and g simply counts the discontinuity. So g equals 1 is the last discontinuity, g equals 2 is the second last, and so on. Okay. Now, just to take some of the mystery away from ionization, there has been some confusion, in my opinion, in the literature about this. There is actually another way to interpret ionization, which is dynamical friction. So dynamical friction is a well-known effect in astrophysical systems where you have an object that moves through a medium with which it interacts gravitationally. So the object loses energy because it's going through the medium. And, you know, if the binary is very compact and at some point it's going through the dense region where the cloud is. And by the way, I haven't said this, but these clouds can become quite massive. So superradiance can grow a cloud up to 10% of the mass of the central black hole. That's a very dense environment. So it's not too surprising that when you go through such a dense environment, you lose a lot of energy. The problem is that the usual treatment of dynamical friction use different assumptions. They use uniform media, straight motion, and so on. Nevertheless, both numerical and theoretical arguments show that the back reaction of ionization is, in fact, dynamical friction. So this is another way you can think about it. Okay, we also have studied ionization for generic orbits, so for eccentric and inclined orbits, while the results I was showing earlier only held for equatorial quasi-circular. So if you have non-zero eccentricity, I mean, we can compute ionization power, but maybe a more interesting question is to ask, does ionization circularize or eccentrify the binary? And the answer is that it's a bit complicated. It usually circularizes the binary at large enough semi-major axis, but it can eccentrify it, so this region here, at very small separations. You can also understand this intuitively if you look at the density profile of the cloud. But what matters here is that when you get very close, gravitational wave emission starts to become more and more important. And as you will know, gravitational waves typically circularize the binary. So when you take them into account, this region of eccentrification here is generally washed away. So the combined effect of gravitational waves and ionization is to generally circularize the binary, unless you take some extreme parameters like a very massive cloud, then you can still get a small region of eccentrification, like in this case. So just take the claim of circularization with a grain of salt. About inclined orbits, also here, rather than discussing the ionization power for inclined orbits, I guess it's more interesting to ask, how does this impact the position of the orbital plane? What you can have is either a precession of the orbital plane or a change in the inclination, which I've called beta here. Beta is the inclination angle. And we have shown that there is no precession induced by ionization. The cloud can induce precession of the orbital plane in other ways, but not due to ionization. While there is a change in the inclination angle, however, the change is typically small. Throughout an in-spiral, it usually changes by a few degrees. So it's a fairly small effect. Okay. Next topic. So resonances and ionization are the two most striking phenomena of gravitational atoms in binaries. Now, if you actually want to characterize what you what can you possibly see in a in an experiment, say LISA, that will fly in 15 years, what can it actually see? So LISA sees a frequency that correspond to the where ionization is most efficient, and also where you have resonances between states with different principal quantum number. We call them Bohr resonances because they have a Bohr splitting. Instead, if you have resonances between states with the same quantum number, for example, 2p to 2s, then the energy splitting is much smaller. We call them fine resonances, so reminiscent of the fine structure. And then you also have the hyperfine resonances if they are they happen between states with the hyperfine splitting. Now, these ones, so the smallest the energy splitting, the smallest the frequency, so the earliest they happen in the spiral. So the point is to actually characterize what you can see. So what's the state of the cloud, what's the configuration of the binary, when it gets in band, gravitational wave interferometer, you actually have to study the whole history of the system. So what happens when it goes through the hyperfine resonances, the fine resonances, and so on. So so what I'm talking about here is these are results that are yet to appear. They haven't been published yet. So I will try to explain them mainly filling up this figure. and I will not have time to go into many details, but the most important points to keep in mind is that, first of all, it's crucial to understand early, so generally hyperfine and fine resonances, and that they are usually all of the floating type. So as a reminder, floating is when the inspiral is low down, so the frequency increases slower than you would expect without the cloud. So they are floating resonances, and the final state, so the state you're transitioning to, is not super radiant. Instead, it's a decaying state. Some states can, you know, some states are populated by super radiants, others are absorbed by the black hole. If you compare the time scale of the duration of the resonance, so the floating time scale, with a decay time scale, then usually the latter is much quicker. So, in fact, if you ever trigger this kind of resonance, you are almost always destroying the cloud because it's going to be absorbed by the black hole before the resonance ends. Also, all these floating resonances tend to be very strong for small inclinations, so co-rotating when the binary and the black and the spin of the cloud are aligned, while they are while they vanish when the spins are anti-aligned. So this means that there must exist by continuity some angular interval around the anti-aligned configuration where the resonance is weak enough so that the cloud actually survives because the resonance is not able to destroy it. And just to say, this is actually a very complicated problem because it depends on, like, the evolution of the frequencies are highly nonlinear. You cannot just use the criterion of checking the value of the Landau-Zener parameter. So you have to solve a much more complicated problem. But so in the end, the answer is that there is an angular interval, which I'm calling here delta one, around the anti-aligned configuration, such that if the inclination of the binary is within this interval, then the cloud survives. So the binary is able to go past the hyperfine region with the cloud still intact. This is of the order of usually 10 degrees or so. So it's quite narrow, but not too narrow. What about fine resonances? The story is quite similar. There are some differences, but roughly speaking, you have a second angular interval, call it delta two, such that if you are within this region, you also get past fine resonances. So I'm depicting here with this gray line, a system that is close enough to the anti-aligned configuration. This doesn't trigger any strong hyperfine resonance nor fine resonance, and finally gets in the nice region here where it's in the LISA band, where ionization is most efficient, and where also a large number of instead of sinking, not floating, Bohr resonances also affect the signal on top of ionization. Instead, other systems that start that have other values of orbital inclination will destroy the cloud whenever they encounter any of the early resonances, like in this case, or in this case, or in this case. The latter case here, what's the difference between these cases here is that it's conceivable that depending on the formation mechanism of the binary, it doesn't start at large enough separations to actually trigger any of the hyperfine resonances. So you may form the binary when it's already close enough that it skips the hyperfine resonances, so the only the fine resonances are triggered. Another more extreme option is that it keeps all the early resonances all together. In that case, there's no constraint on the inclination angle, so it gets in the interesting region in any case. However, to form a binary at such small separations, you need some special formation mechanism. For example, astrophysicists studied in situ formation in accretion disks, where compact objects are formed at in dense environments at very small initial separations. Okay, so as a summary of the resonant history, the cloud survives, and so you get very interesting observational signatures if you're close enough to the anti-aligned or counter-rotating configuration, and so you see ionization and a number of sinking resonances.
Sorry, just a quick question on the previous slide. What is the order of magnitude of delta 2? It's smaller than delta 1?
No, it's similar. Here, it's just to make it clear, it's also the order of a few degrees, up to 10 degrees or so.
Okay, thanks.
In some cases, delta 2 may also be larger than delta 1. Here, it's just to have something nice on the plot. So the case where you get interesting observational signatures is the counter-rotating or anti-aligned case, or like within an angular region from this configuration. In all the other cases, the cloud is generally destroyed. So this may sound not very interesting. However, the resonance that destroys the cloud also has a back reaction on the binary. So while it destroys the cloud, it also changes the eccentricity and the inclination of the binary. Now, in the abstract I sent for this talk, I make a bolder claim than I actually want to make in the talk. What I'm going to say is that generally speaking, early resonances circularize the binary and make it more co-rotating, so they reduce the inclination angle. So even if you destroy the cloud here, it's in principle possible to do a statistical analysis on a population of binary black holes of which you can measure eccentricity and inclination. And if you are good enough and you can exclude any other astrophysical mechanism that may also cause a circular and spin-aligned configurations, this can hint to the presence of an earlier cloud that was destroyed during a resonance. Okay, I think I'm almost done. So I'll just say very, very shortly that we also have computed something that is not quite an inspiring binary, but something quite related. So if you send the eccentricity to one, you have the dynamical capture scenario where you have a marginally bound object that swings by close the central black hole. Even without the cloud, when you have such a close approach, you can emit, so you emit a soft burst of gravitational waves, and the energy loss might be strong enough to make the orbit bound. So this is a mechanism of binary formation. When you do have a cloud, basically you have additional energy loss. So the cross section for this process, I'm going to show this plot here. So the total cross section, including the cloud, divided by the cross section without the cloud, can increase by roughly an order of magnitude or so for relative velocities of the two objects that are astrophysically relevant. So 10 to the minus 3, 10 to minus 4. Okay, I'm done. I'll just leave my summary here. I just want to remind everybody, all results here are derived in a non-relativistic approximation. This is an approximation, but is well justified, and some, I mean, eventually we need to go beyond this if you want to search these objects in with future gravitational waves detectors. But there has been an interesting recent numerical work that reproduces some of our results relativistically. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the nice talk. So one question I had, so in this talk, for most of your kind of fiducial binary parameters, you concentrated on like 10 to the 4 solar masses, like even though, as you mentioned, maybe black holes of that size are less certain. So can you say a little bit about what happens if you try to consider this for 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes? Is it that the frequencies are not right for LISA, or that it's hard to get the mass ratios right with the stellar mass object, or
exactly? So, yeah, that's a very good question. So, look, if you look at this formula here, so everything works the same. We do use the small mass ratio, small mass ratio approximation in many of our calculations. So, if you keep a Q, so the mass ratio is small, it's all fine. However, you like if you increase M toward supermassive black holes, then this frequency becomes quite small. So you're not going to see the interesting stuff like the resonances and the kinks due to the ionization discontinuity. That being said, you will still be able to probe the later stages of the spiral. So for example, you may be able to see, do you see my cursor?
Yeah, we see it.
You may be able to see not the discontinuities, but something like in the tail here, where the effect becomes, subdominant compared to gravitational waves, but still it's quite a large correction anyway. So yeah, everything applies, but it's a little bit less interesting, maybe.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry, can I follow up that question? So can you flash that equation again?
So I'm confused. So why can I not think of a 10 to the 6 solar mass object in the numerator and the main sequence star in the denominator that's 100 solar mass, like have the same ratio?
No, so this is 10 to the 4 solar masses divided by the mass of the central black hole.
Oh.
This frequency does not depend on the mass of the secondary object as long as the mass ratio is very small.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Good luck then if that's a ratio, that these are the masses you're thinking about.
Well, the point is, it's, you know, we know that black holes of 10 to the solar masses, 10 solar masses exist. We know that black holes with 10 to the 6 and above solar masses exist. We don't know about these masses here. I think there is one confirmed intermediate mass black hole. But I think this is a sweet spot for the most interesting phenomena, but it's not the only one. Another idea is to look at not future gravitational wave interferometers, but at least not as low frequency as LISA, but something like Einstein telescope, and they can be sensitive to lower masses, like 10 to the 2 or so, where you would have the kinks and the resonances in band. So it's not like this number here is not a strict requirement.
But just to follow up on that thought, so you have two parameters you can tune, right? So you have the total mass, but you also have alpha.
Correct.
So can you not compensate one, with the other?
Partially. So alpha cannot be too small or too large. Otherwise, super radiance is too slow. The cloud doesn't grow fast enough on astrophysical time scales. That being said, yes, you can leverage a bit.
It's a cube. It's a cubed relationship, right? So
it is a cube. Yeah. So, but you cannot boost alpha by an order of magnitude. That's what I want to say.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.
In fact, some of the earlier works, I have actually changed this equation with respect to the one in the original paper. They actually were thinking of LIGO-Virgo binaries. So they had this relation written with 60 solar masses. And the frequency here was, I don't remember exactly, but like, I think, I don't know, some hertz. Something like that. So, it's 10 to the 4 solar masses is not a strict requirement.
Can you just come back to the other equation you had before? Yeah. If you take M to be 10 solar masses, don't you get something of the order of the hertz? So.
Yes. Though this is the.
So that...
the... Yes, so that would be LIGO, Virgo.
Yeah, exactly.
However, remember that this is the big black hole. Because the big black hole is 10 solar masses. You don't have much room to play with a small one. If you want the mass ratio to be very small, you can do it. You can take 10 solar masses and one solar mass. So what happens is that, now I'm not showing this, but if you increase the mass ratio, then not only the binary loses a lot of energy, but the cloud loses a lot of mass as well, just because the perturbation from the more massive secondary is more important, right? So the cloud gets depleted before you actually arrive in the interesting region, if you have too large a mass ratio.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? I actually wanted to ask, so I guess you're kind of restricted to the region of parameter space where your cloud has grown in the time since the black hole formed, and also that it hasn't decayed.
Correct.
So what kind of range of alpha does that correspond to?
Yeah, good question. So this actually the answer depends on the state of the cloud. So for example, for the 2-1-1 state, so that is the one that usually grows the fastest, alpha has to be roughly larger than 0.05, and it can never be larger than 0.5. Because otherwise this state cannot be unstable at all. If alpha is though very large, so the lower bound is to ensure that the cloud grows fast enough. The upper bound is both to ensure that the instability is there and that the cloud doesn't decay too fast. Though it doesn't change too much. It's 0.4 or something like that. It also depends on what do you choose as what can you accept as time scale of decay of the cloud.
So it's quite a big range.
It's a big range, but also want to say one thing: the decay of the cloud is actually not exponential. This is something that I think is not appreciated enough in the literature, in my opinion. The cloud decays, so I haven't said this, but the cloud itself decays in gravitational wave over long times. So that's why you have this decay, this depletion. But that's not an exponential decay, it's a polynomial decay. So even if you wait one or two orders of magnitude longer than the time scale of decay, the cloud is not completely gone. It's just that the mass is reduced by one or two orders of magnitude. And if you look at, for example, this plot here, you still get some interesting number if you reduce the mass by a factor of 10 or so. So it's not a very sharp bound, the one coming from the decay of the cloud.
Okay, thank you. And if there aren't any more questions, let's thank the speaker again.